up. It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. Before I get to my guests today, two guests, quick programming note again. This podcast is ending soon. Sorry to say, at least on this feed, it will be no more. I will have one more episode after this one. That will be either Monday, if the finals end in 5 or 6 games, or if it does somehow go to 7, the last episode will come the day after that. So one more episode after this. I will be back with a new podcast, new platform, new name, sometime later this year. But you won't find it on this feed. So here's what I need you to do, folks. Go to howardbeck.com. Yes, I created a website with my own name. howardbeck.com. Enter your email address there. I'm going to create a mailing list, and I will send you the news as soon as I have it about where my podcast will be, where you can subscribe, all that. Don't want you to miss out, and appreciate you all following me along to the next thing. You can also follow me on Twitter at Howard Beck. I'll have the news there too, but the email address would be great. So howardbeck.com, send me your email address. I will keep you apprised. With all that out of the way, very pleased to welcome two guests today, two of the best national NBA writers out there. And we were all teammates once upon a time at the Los Angeles Daily News. And a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. With a lot less money. We don't need to go there. They have co-authored a new book on Hall of Famer Spencer Haywood called The Spencer Haywood Rule, Battles, Basketball, and the Making of an American Iconoclast. We'll discuss that, finals, and some other stuff. Gary Washburn of the Boston Globe, Mark Spears of the Undefeated. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for coming on.
Keep the name, man. You own that name, brother. Don't leave that name with them.
I'm going to go with the Full 49.
No, that's your name. I'll tell them now. They give it to somebody else. I ain't listening. That's Howard Beck's name.
I'll hire you as my attorney, Spears, and you can fight that legal battle for me.
All right.
You guys are, before we get to everything else, you guys are both coming to me live from the bubble on this Thursday evening, and your time in the bubble is coming to a close soon. If not tomorrow, then Sunday. And if not Sunday, then next Wednesday. Mark, Gary, how long have you each been in the bubble? How ready are you to leave?
We both got here the same day, July 12th.
Okay.
So I think it's 88 days now.
Yeah, it's 88 days.
Everybody's anxious to get home. I think it's been an amazing experience. Met some great friends, met reporters that I really hadn't known very well and gotten to know them, and other people in the business and in the league. So it's been an amazing experience, but it's really winding down. And I think everybody's ready to get back to whatever we would consider normal life.
I think it's also been a big, big pleasure and honor to be here, being a part of history. There's a lot of people that could have been in our place. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of documentaries, there's going to be a lot of books, there's going to be a lot of stories written about this. And to say not only that we've been here, but that we've been here for such a long time, have so many stories, so many experiences. I'll never forget this, man. It's starting to get nostalgic, a little nostalgic. Gee, I was thinking about what it's going to be like when we're driving out to the airport, you know, just kind of waving goodbye, like, so long, partner, you know. But it's, I definitely have been getting kind of like taking some Polaroids in my mind lately.
Little wistful. That's wild. I mean, it's a slice of history. This is NBA history. This is sports history. And you guys were there to witness it firsthand. That is still the source of my biggest source of FOMO on this whole thing, is just to have missed out on something so unique and momentous. What's the first thing you each are going to do when you get home? Spears back to Oakland and Gary back to Boston.
Well, I wanted to get some gumbo from one of my guys, but he gives it on Friday. So I got to hook him up. There's a chef in Oakland. God, what's my guy's name? I'm going to look it up, give him a shout out. So maybe he gives it to me for free.
I figured it had to be food. If I had been somewhere for 90 days, I think the first thing I'd want to do when I got back, it definitely would be food related.
Well, the other stuff, this is a family show. So I would say, you know, shout out to Chef Kenneth Wynn, man. I need some of that gumbo. I would love to get a big pot of his gumbo and just sit down and do nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Gary?
Just sit on my couch. I mean, and just relax and watch TV and not have to get tested every day. Although that's not a bad, good thing, because we're going kind of back into the polluted world. Because this is the safest place on earth, to be honest with you.
It is.
It's not only the happiest place on earth, but it's the safest place on earth. And that's a concern. I mean, because nobody here is tested positive. So it has been a very amazing experience. And the NBA has done all it can to make sure everybody's safe. So, yeah, go get some Thai food or some Vietnamese food or something. Just do stuff that you're used to. Go back to my kickboxing class, things that I said I haven't done all summer and all since. And so, yeah, just regular stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody keeps asking, what are you going to do when you get back? Like, I'm not, you know, like,
nothing.
Nothing. We're not traveling.
No.
You know, oh, I'm going to Europe now. Like, no, it's just get used to being home.
Yeah.
You know what I did, Howard, that I admit this. I don't know if I told you, Gary. Like, Howard, we're basically eating convention food every day.
Like box lunch sandwiches?
No, it's just like the people that like cook food for like conventions and weddings and meetings and stuff like that. That it's catered, basically, what I'm saying.
Okay. Yeah.
So we definitely get offered a lot of food, a lot of snacks, a lot of things, but it's all catered food.
So there's not much variety and probably not much spice or anything. Like
whoever the NBA dietitian is, they need to fire that dude immediately. his thoughts on what's healthy is like incredibly bad. But so speaking of bad food, I actually like looked up what they serve at the Orlando airport. So I'm like, man, an Egg McMuffin, boy. Woo! That's going to be all right. Like, that's like really good eating to me right now.
If that's what you're looking forward to, that's a really sad statement.
No, I mean, just like anything. Like, we haven't had anything we wanted. I think we've eaten at two restaurants, one off camp, one at the Grand Floridian, and once here. And that's only one of the times that we actually get to order something that we want. You know what I mean? It's strange. It's like little things, but it's like a big deal.
All right, how about this before we move on to serious matters of the NBA?
This is more interesting than basketball, man. Forget basketball.
Well, considering the state of this series, unfortunately, is there anything you'll actually miss about the bubble? Like, what's one thing like you're thinking like, ah, man, I'm kind of sorry we're leaving because of what?
Go ahead, G.
You make relationships and friendships, you know, you see guys every day, you've gotten to know people. We're all kind of a family now because we've all gone through the same experience. So, and then everybody at Disney is so damn nice. I mean, literally, all the employees wave at you or say hello. Like, that whole atmosphere is I'm going to miss. And just kind of the camaraderie we've all, you know, developed. And also missing basketball, missing this amazing access we have. Missing that, you know, the 22 teams. I mean, it was amazing, Howard. Like, when it was 22 teams here, I mean, it was like literally 300 different guys. And so when they all would get out of practice around the same time, not all 300, but like several teams, the convention lobby was like the happening spot. Guys would be hanging out, and you'd just see X guy from X team. I mean, it was such a, like a basketball convention. It was just so surreal. Like, especially the first couple of weeks before they obviously got down to, you know, eight teams and four. Now it's a ghost town. But, man, that first few weeks here was just surreal. Like, okay, what practice do you want to go to? Who do you want to talk to? Who's here? Sacramento, San Antonio, you know, Memphis, Phoenix, like whatever team. I mean, what coach? And they were right there. And so that's going to be interesting to just kind of like that's never going to happen again.
No.
The players will never agree to this again. Like, let's be honest. Like, the players will never do this again. They'll walk away, especially if the Lakers win or whoever wins a championship, and they'll use it and think it as a great experience. But most guys were ready to get the hell out of here. So, I will miss the camaraderie and miss a lot of the people here.
It does sound for all the obvious impediments or just restrictions. It does sound like it's been an amazing experience for you guys.
Yeah, no, I gotten a couple of new hobbies. Like, I wanted to learn something while I was here and also get an excuse to kind of get off the property. So I picked up fishing. And so, and Gary went, how many times did you go, Gary? Like twice?
Twice. I went to twice, yeah.
Yeah. I went like six or seven times. And I was horrible in the beginning. And then last time I ended up catching seven fish. And then because the Rockets were the last team at that Grand Floridian Hotel, they shut that down for us. So I was really like sad. Another thing I picked up is bike riding. I got back into riding a bike every day. The gym started getting a little, like a lot of funny stuff was happening in the gym in terms of you know, them cleaning it every other hour, cutting workouts to 30 minutes. And I'm like, I need to do something longer. So I actually started riding a bike and got to love it so much that I bought a bike back home that's ready for me to pick up when I get back.
Nice.
So I'm going to get into bike riding again. Well, I've gotten into bike riding again, but kind of like what G said, like we got like a group of dudes we hang with like a lot. And then you hang out with the refs sometimes. And then you hang out with, like I'll hang out with the, we'll have like ESPN dinners and then bigger groups. We've like watched debates together, watch Richard Pryor together. That stuff is cool. And there are people here that maybe I didn't get to talk to them a lot, but if I see them out somewhere, we'll probably end up having a long conversation because we'll always, you know, be connected to this. So this is something we're going to have fun talking about, man, forever.
Very cool. All right. So I don't want to dwell too much on Game 5, which is tomorrow, about 24-plus hours from now, because I think by the time some people listen to this, that game might have been over. The series might be over, for that matter. So I want to go a little big picture here in case people listening before or after. Can we all agree, first of all, that the Lakers are going to win this, whether it's Friday, Sunday, or Wednesday? Or excuse me, Tuesday. Friday, Sunday, Tuesday.
I'm not going to let you jinx me, man. I'm not going to let you. I'm not counting out Jimmy Butler just yet, man. Like,
all right.
One thing that scares me about the Lakers is they seem like anytime they're in an advantageous position, they hit cruise control. And so I expect LeBron to take it up to like a close it, knock you out level. But these Heat guys, man, they've survived a lot. They're not going to just give it to them. So, yeah, I expect that to happen, but I feel like if I say it, then I'm leaving on Wednesday.
And which, of course, as we all know, this is the golden rule among NBA reporters. It's not that we ever have a rooting interest. The only rooting is for ourselves and to get to go home sooner rather than later, especially after an experience like this one, I imagine.
No, but I will say this. If this was a game five, we'd be in L.A., right?
Yeah.
So we'd actually be rooting for the Lakers to win, so we'd go back to Miami.
No, or for
we were in a real world
for the Heat to win to go back to Miami.
Yeah.
And then one more trip back to LA again. Yeah. way more miles that way too. At that point,
there ain't no miles here.
No,
there's
no
a bus that we get on.
Are you at least getting hotel points, you guys?
No
hotel. God, man,
no.
90 days of no hotel it. Points, 90 man. Days of a hotel with no hotel points. Man. That is, for a sports writer, that is the most painful thing I could possibly imagine.
Dude, if we were at a Marriott right now, oh my goodness.
That would be great.
Yeah, we would have been
like
the highest level.
Yeah, platinum elite. I mean.
No, they're more higher than that.
No points.
No, just we're very, if you want to know about the Coronado Springs property, we could let you know everything you want to know.
Right down probably to like where you can find a spare outlet, the every ice machine.
Yeah.
So assuming the Lakers win this, whenever it is, game five, game six, game seven, I mean, I picked the Lakers in seven before the series started. And of course, things are different because of the Dragic injury, the Adebayo injury. We're not exactly where we thought this series would be when it started, at least not what I thought it would be. I thought it would be a long series, and maybe it still will. Assuming the Lakers win, they're obviously in a commanding position right now. Gary, what do you think it means for LeBron? Like, his legacy was already set. I've always said this, if he retired 3 years ago, we'd know where he was, but everything else is just additive now. So what does it do for him if assuming that they walk off with the championship sometime soon?
I mean, I think it adds to his legacy, three titles with three different teams. You know, I think it's just so unfair to compare him to Jordan because he's not Jordan. And I don't think, you know, Jordan is 6-0. I mean, I don't think he can ever compete with 6-0. And just every time he got in there, he got it done. He won. But I think the thing about LeBron is Jordan, although he had his 2 years with the Wizards, he's a Bull. With LeBron now, there's like three LeBrons. Obviously, there's Cavs LeBron, there's Heat LeBron. Now there's Lakers LeBron. And so for three different eras of your career to be able to win titles with three different teams, I think that says a lot about his legacy. I think that's he realizes how important that is. And I think he said something at practice this week was like, L.A. fans don't care anything about what you did before you got there. It's like, where's our chip? And I think that's exactly what he's kind of thinking. Like, yeah, like, I'm not going to be like, hey, I might be greater than Kobe in a top 10 list. I might be greater than Kareem in a top 10 list, but I ain't won a title in L.A. yet. So I am, to a Laker fan, I am 50th or 37th until – you know, Michael Cooper's ahead of me, Byron Scott's ahead of me, Michael Thompson's ahead of me. Like, you talking about Laker greatness? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, those guys are Laker greats. Robert Horry, all the guys, James Worthy. So LeBron knows that a championship in L.A. will get him to another level. And I think it does get him to another level.
Spears, I agree with everything Wash has said, first of all. But I would just add this. Like, because Lakers exceptionalism is a thing, it exists. The first thing that Gary said about LeBron and how he establishes himself there or how he's remembered there, like, I think that's almost the most important part. Getting to a fourth title, I don't know if people will distinguish in the long term 3 versus 4 versus 5, but the one you get in LA because of who the Lakers are and because of how that fan base views its team, like, it doesn't mean anything until you have a championship there. And like that one, they'll all mean something different. Getting Cleveland, you know, on the board after 50 years in any sport is important. The two in Miami, because their first two are important. But like, I do think this one feels like it's got something added to it. Spears, what about AD? What does this mean for him? His first, we'll start debating soon. Maybe we'll talk about it in a second here, the MVP discussion, which, you know, it's still in flux, but are we going to see Anthony Davis differently based on this?
Yeah, no. I mean, he'll be a champ. No one can take that away from him. He'll be his first. So I always like seeing guys win their first titles and looking at their emotions. You wonder if the emotions will be a little different because they're in this bubble environment, but I don't think so. I mean, Anthony has worked hard for this. Health has really been probably his biggest foe during his whole career. So, you know, this environment actually was helpful to him in terms of not traveling, being in one spot. And then the Lakers, you know, really hadn't been challenged prior to coming to the finals. So they never played, I don't think, any more than five games, right? So I forgot what the Houston one was, but they never were really challenged. And so for him, his dad will be there, family members will be there. I think his child and the mother is going to be there. Like, I could see him breaking down. I could see Dwight Howard, you've been around Dwight Howard, like, breaking down. And so those are the kind of the cool things to see. And then also you got the drunk player, the David West and the Scalabrinis of the world, and you get look forward to hearing what they got to say. But for Anthony Davis, it will be, I think, a very emotional special night that he'll never forget. And then the interesting thing is, Howard, like, I wonder what the party will be like here. Like, where will they party at? Like, will it be, they love this place called Three Bridges, where they don't let me and Gary go to. They don't let the media go to. But Gary, maybe we're going there for breakfast tomorrow, Gary. Hell with it.
Let's do it. Yeah.
Who's going to stop you?
Yeah, so I could see them because LeBron James loves the place, like having a big party there. But I'm also wondering, like, what the referee party, they have their own party all the time, what the media party, like, what the environment in the bubble is going to be like, because it's almost also going to be a goodbye party
Yeah.
For everybody involved.
I wondered, have you guys asked at all about this? I've been curious. I asked Jeannie Buss about this earlier in the week and she didn't know, but like what happens at the moment that the championship is clinched? And we, you know, normally what we see is like, there's all this stuff, right? There's the confetti and everything that happens. And, you know, then family then comes on the court and the stage rolls out and all this. There is some family there, obviously. Mark, you alluded to some of them. I don't know how many guys have people there. At that point, though,
both of these teams have a large contingent of people, I would say.
Okay, but there, a lot of them are also secondary. Like, Jeannie is in secondary bubble. Pat Riley's in the secondary bubble. The Arisons are in the secondary bubble. They're not in the primary. So, in theory, they're not supposed to come into contact with anybody who's in the real bubble. Do we have any sense of, like...
Let the players get their... Let the players get the just due. They're the ones that play.
They still won't, Gary? It'll still be all separated?
No. Yep, because if you're in that second tier where Riley is, like Rob Pelinka's in the first tier, Kurt Rambis, a couple of Heat, like third level, like number three
Adam
guy.
Adam Simon's here for the Heat.
Like, yeah, but you're talking about Riley or Arison or the Buss family. If they're in the second tier, they cannot come down on the court. So, no, they
even,
will not
even at the
drop.
End. Even at the end where there's no risk of.
Not,
yeah,
no.
I mean, there's still,
hell
obviously.
No.
The, yeah.
I don't want them down there.
Yeah.
They will not drop their COVID protocol for
to a celebration.
Pat Riley or Jeannie Buss on the floor to hug LeBron. That's going to have to happen somewhere in L.A.
Maybe the flight back, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly.
But they may because, like, for example, is Mike Breen, right? I think Mike Breen would have the ability to walk over to their suite and perhaps do an interview with them, you know, from above. But I think everybody in the bubble is so paranoid about you dirty people on the outside, like non-testing folks on the outside, that until we're released back into the water, so to speak, we ain't trying to be next to y'all.
I just think it's going to be really interesting, guys, because it is among the other oddities or just strangeness of the bubble and the things that we'll see not only on this championship, but looking back years from the future as we're looking back on it, it will always look and feel so, so different. The games themselves, the highlights without the normal background of and the atmosphere. And then in this case, with the championship itself, it's so much about the emotions of the moment and the gratification of whether it's team governors or the GMs, the coaches, the families of these people. And we see all that. And like that is going to be so muted. I mean, the emotions will still be intense for everybody who's there, but there'll be a lot of people who are missing from that scene. And I am curious about that when we finally see it. What's the Lakers' window to do more with this? When we talk about LeBron's legacy and we talk about, okay, he can't be 6-0, but he gets four now. All of a sudden, six is like not crazy to talk about anymore. AD has to re-sign. I'm not sure if he's even going to opt out given the uncertainty of the cap, but he's got 1 year left on his deal after this. They've got some older guys, Danny Green, Rondo, Dwight. Do we just assume, and again, I'm talking as if they've won this, apologies to the Heat, but do we assume that the Lakers have a longer run here?
No. I'm seeing what Golden State's doing, you know, how they're going to look when, who are they going to get or what they're going to do with the pick. I assume the Clippers will be better. Denver's for real. Like, let's see what they're like next year. And that's not to say that the Lakers shouldn't be the favorite, but I think the West, I mean, Doncic, Porzingis, the West is stacked. And I also think this might be the first time next season that the East doesn't have one horrendous team.
You sure?
I mean, like that you can't, in which you don't have to show up against. I even think you're going to have to show up against Cleveland. I think they're going to be a team where, if you don't show up, they'll get you. Orlando has been a playoff team for a few years. Trae Young, I think, is going to make Atlanta a better team. I think maybe the Bulls might be that team, I guess. But the parity in the league, I think, will be as good as it's ever been.
Yeah, I think the Lakers, I think as long as you have LeBron and AD, you've got out a window. They're just going to have to create ways to bring younger guys on their squad, you know, whether it be re-sign Rondo and Howard to like, you know, mid-level deals or split the mid-level or how you just get creative ways to get some guys back. And then also, you know, I mean, do you get younger? I know the kid from Iowa State is showing some things this year. Horton Tucker, will he have a bigger role? What happens with McGee? You know, I just think they're going to have some stuff to figure out. But I think any team with LeBron and AD is going to be competitive. You know, they're going to compete for a championship. LeBron did not go there just to win one title and then lose in the second round in his third year. And the Lakers understand, obviously, LeBron has got to opt out again from his third season. And if, as you mentioned, Howard, if AD opts in for that 1 year, then everything's on next year, right? Because of it, you know, they've got to put the pressure on Pelinka to revamp the roster, because this roster has some holes. I mean, I think I've read, I forgot who wrote it, but this is not an all-time great Laker team. I mean, you're not going to put this up against the Kobe Shaq, and you're not going to put this up against the mid-2010 Warriors. This is a team that's flawed, but just has two great superstars and then guys who know their roles and help out and kind of do it in a, like, they take turns. In game four, it was KCP. And then there's been time, Rondo's been magnificent in the playoffs. But they could definitely, I mean, obviously, they got some dead weight on their roster, get some of the J.R. Smiths and the Deion Waiters and get those guys out, try to draft well. And I think they can definitely make another run.
Yeah, I think the window is there, but it's a window that is, to Spears' point, it's a window that's going to be, I don't know what the right analogy is. There's just going to be a lot of stuff on that window, or a lot of things in the way between the Warriors, the Clippers, the Nuggets. There's just like the window is there. It's possible to repeat and possible to win another one or two. Some while LeBron still has is playing at an MVP level, which he clearly still is. I just think, yeah, it's going to be tough. Now, but who knows? They're doing it this time with a two-star model. Maybe they snag that third star somewhere along the way here. You know, there's, you know, the next disgruntled star who wants to be traded to a big market or a glamour market is always around the corner in this league, right? Yeah. So no shortage of guys who want to play in L.A. or play for the Lakers. Real quick, just yes or no with a quick explanation. Did the bubble play any significant role at all in the outcome of this postseason?
I believe so. I mean, first, I want to give kudos for the teams that made it to the finals, because you certainly had to have some mental strength to get here. The way I think it affected it is from a good health standpoint. You know, you're not traveling, you're not as fatigued, you're in one place. They had the opportunity to just basically go downstairs and work out in the gym whenever they wanted to. And so it also helped the players get better camaraderie with their own teammates and focus like solely on basketball. But, you know, when you look at teams like the Clippers, it was evident that this had a negative effect on them. They just mentally didn't handle it well. They had a lot of COVID issues, personal issues. So for me, I think, yeah, it definitely had an effect. And people keep talking about asterisk for champions. I think it should be asterisk that's celebrated, because there certainly was a lot to go through all this to get to your title.
Yeah, I think as Mark is right, like the guys were able to concentrate. They had nothing but, I mean, the NBA made it very easy for these guys to train. I mean, they turned these ballrooms into practice facilities and gyms, like complete two-court practice. You should see, I don't know if you got a chance to look at the tape, but some of these practice facilities were plush, great weight. They built weight rooms in the back, weight areas. Guys could treat, you know, get their treatment. Like they were not devoid of any type of the amenities in terms of like what they're used to in the bubble. I think it definitely affected the playoffs. Does Denver win games 5 and 7 at L.A.? Probably not. Boston lost literally, like, I think six home games. Like, they lost all three games that were supposed to be in Boston and Toronto. They lost the first two to Miami that was supposed to be at home. So I think, like, the neutral court definitely played a part in probably who made to the finals. I said, like, as much as I think the Clippers collapsed, what they had lost games 5 and 7 in L.A., at the Staples Center, probably not. They probably win that series. It probably isn't pretty, but the fact that neutral floor, no atmosphere, and I do think, too, Howard, that, like, guys were the bubble monster was knocking on their shoulder, like, hey, ain't you ready to leave? Hey, if you lose, hey, you be home tomorrow night. There were some, believe me, Howard, as much as guys didn't want to say it, there were some guys who were glad to get the hell out of here. Like, they were okay losing in the playoffs. They would not admit it. They'll say they worked hard, but there were a lot of guys ready to get back into their, you know, nice homes and pools and hang with their families and go to their favorite places after getting knocked out of the playoffs. I mean, there were some guys that were very pleased with how it went down.
And I can't, and I'm sure nobody would, I can't blame them for that.
Yeah.
That, I mean, this whole thing has been abnormal to say the least. And I feel like what, you know, you probably have some specifics in mind, Gary, like you don't have to say right now. Like, you probably know specific players, specific teams that were maybe most affected. And it's the kind of thing that sometimes in the moment, that stuff is not aired out. But I think in the weeks, months to come, we'll probably hear more from the players themselves, probably, too, where there'll be more that we'll learn about just how hard this was on guys, things that were weighing on them, how difficult this really was, and why, you know, and not just for fun and games to go home or just to lay by the pool, but, like, for other reasons. Like, I think we'll learn a lot more about what happened in the bubble probably long after the bubble has ceased. That's often the way this happens, right? We get the first draft of history as guys like us, you know, just kind of catch up as we go. And then sometimes it's weeks and months later when people are more comfortable talking about stuff. But I do think there's a lot more that we're going to learn there, inevitably. I want to talk about your guys' book, because this is like such a fascinating piece of NBA history and in one man's story, but one man who, like, saw and experienced, like, everything in Spencer Haywood. And especially for, you know, younger fans, which I think, you know, a lot of people who follow any of our work these days, they skew younger and probably don't know of Spencer Haywood, maybe know his name, maybe they know he's a Hall of Famer, but they might not know about the things he's been through, whether it was extreme poverty growing up in the South, the racism that he experienced, intense racism from the things I saw and read in your book, cocaine addiction that he went through in the midst of his career. I don't think I knew or maybe had forgotten that he was actually suspended in the 1980 finals while with the Lakers, like booted from the finals.
Yeah, you could imagine if that happened today.
Oh, like, my God.
Well, I mean, during Game 3, like, basically they tell you, you're not coming to Philly with us, and you can practice or you can work out at our facility, but you're done. Yeah, you could imagine he fell asleep at a practice, and, yeah, you could imagine if that happened, obviously, 40 years from now today. His story is fascinating.
It is for everything that I just mentioned and so much more that's in your guys' book. And you titled the book The Spencer Haywood Rule, which is something that, again, for people who don't know the short version, it's Spencer Haywood and his legal challenge to the NBA back in the early 70s that led to the elimination of any age limit. Now, people know of the NBA now as having an age limit, but this is a collectively bargained age limit, 19 years old, 1 year removed from high school. The players union signed off on that. It's legal and the players agreed to it. That's the current age limit. But for 25 years, there was no age limit and nobody jumped through that loophole until Kevin Garnett did it in 1995. That was 75
Moses and Bill Willoughby.
Right. So there was a 20-year span where nobody took advantage of it. But the reason anybody could at all, and the reason that Garnett could, and that Kobe could, and Jermaine O'Neal, Tracy McGrady, all of them could, is because Spencer Haywood sued the league and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the reason Spencer Haywood rule as a phrase matters is because Spencer Haywood himself, as he says in your book, as he has said many times in recent years, he kind of wants the recognition for this, for being the trailblazer that he was to pave the way for all these young players. And eventually, sometime in the next few years, presumably even the 1 year limit is going to go away again and we'll be back to what it was after Spencer Haywood successfully sued. Tell me about that first. There's a lot of directions we could take this and a lot of things you guys cover in the book, and it's a fascinating life story that he has. But why is this such a painful point for him that he so badly wants this recognition that he doesn't seem to be getting for breaking down that barrier?
Go ahead, G.
I think his career, he felt very slighted by the NBA, and it started all the way, obviously, back in 1968, 69, when he was one of the top players in the college basketball, amazing sophomore season at the University of Detroit, and he decided to try to go professional, and he signed with the Denver Rockets of the ABA. Then I think the racism thing, and I don't think we view the NBA. It's a league that's been mostly African American for a long, long time. But in the late 60s and early 70s, the NBA had a large amount of white players, and the owners wanted it that way. And Spencer represented young African-American men from the inner city and from schoolyards all over the country who were threatening the league the way it was going, that they wanted it to be. Like, there's going to be a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds, so now that's normal, right? 20, 21 is old for a draft prospect now. But there were a bunch of 18 and 19-year-olds, the George Gervins, the Julius Irvings, who were literally ready to play in the league but weren't allowed to. And Spencer felt like the league made an example out of him because he fought that. And he went all the way to the Supreme Court. And he also got flack from, obviously, other NBA owners who wanted a mostly white league and were threatened by young African-American men here in the league. And also, what people don't really understand is other NBA veterans, black veterans, who were told, hey, these young guys are going to come in and take your jobs, okay? They're going to take food out of your mouth. So do you want these 18, 19-year-olds in the league? You should tell, so he got flack from so many different directions. And there was a level of bitterness, which is understandable, because he kind of felt like the league took it out on him. They made him the face. I think if you know your NBA history, and if not, look it up. In the late 70s and early 80s, the NBA had a real drug issue. There were several players, not only Spencer, who were dabbling in cocaine, who were getting high. Cocaine in 1977, 8, 9, it was a glamorous drug. It was a rich person's drug. And a lot of players, not only Spencer, dabbled in that. Spencer felt like the league made an example out of him and made him the face of the drug rule. They basically kicked him out of the league after this, what happened with the Lakers. So this is a man who felt like he made a lot of strides and helped a lot of young players, which he did, but was never truly given credit for it until well after his career. Obviously, he was inducted to the Naismith Hall of Fame in 2015. But it would be nice, I think, and I think some of the younger players he's told me, Kevin Garnett, Paul George, Kevin Durant, have mentioned him and said, that's the OG, that's the guy who set the groundwork for all of us. But I still think he wants some more, credit, which he deserves, for making that sacrifice that a lot of young players wouldn't, being pulled off the court because the NBA filed an injunction to keep him from playing when he's with the Seattle Sonics. I mean, this is stuff that, obviously, hopefully me and Mark will be part of it, will make a great movie, And so, I think that, Spencer's a man who's lived a complicated life. He's a complicated man who came from such humble beginnings that it's a story that is just so fascinating that I think everyone should read.
Spears, I know you got to jump in a couple minutes here because you got another obligation, but what's the two ways of looking at this? Either the thing you most want people to learn or take away from this book that you guys co-authored, and this is, I should say, this is with Spencer Haywood's full cooperation. Like, he is the narrator through all of this. So he's very much a partner in this with the two of you. What's the thing you most think that you want people to take away from this, or kind of the moral of his story?
Kind of almost like a Forrest Gump, man. He has so many great stories. And I think it's an easy read. One, because, I have an amazing writer that passes me after my Spencer gets me through with my great stories, and then Gary's amazing prose finishes the book, man. But no, Spencer, whether it's talking about being in the cotton fields in Mississippi, about dealing with racism of an extreme manner after JFK dies, or basically being kicked out of his hometown, or being in the Olympics as an 18-year-old with John Carlos and Tommy Smith, watching them get kicked out, to the Lakers, to Iman, to, you know, being in the Hall of Fame. There's just so many stories with him. Like, you don't even have to be a basketball fan to love what's in this book. It just, to me, is like an amazing collection of stories that I really believe that not even an avid book reader would get through it pretty quickly.
Yeah, no, it's a really easy, you know, a quick read in a lot of ways, just because it's a lot of, you know, you guys setting him up to just kind of tell that he's, as you say, Mark, the guy's got amazing stories, and he is, I feel like, almost literally seen it all. And the racism is harrowing. And what strikes me, and that I think people really need to, or I hope they see in this, if they pick up the book, is that Spencer Haywood's 71 years old. He played with Magic Johnson when Magic Johnson was a rookie. This is not ancient history. Like, it always, it often can feel like, even for guys of our generation, it can often feel like the civil rights, you know, era, and that battle was long ago. Like this, and for younger fans of the game, it's now ancient history. But like, there are people around right now who played with players who played with other guys who were just here just yesterday, basically, and they experienced this intensely. And it's not to say that any of these things are gone now either, obviously. But the things that he went through that I read about in your book are just like harrowing. And this is not ancient history by any stretch. Mark, I know you got to leap. Gary, if you want to stick around for a couple more minutes, talk a little bit more about the book, it's great. If you guys both need to jump now,
yeah,
that's
fine.
Okay. Spears, you got to roll?
All right. Stick around.
Thanks, Howard. Yeah, I got to run. Get ready for a Sports Center hit.
Yeah, yeah.
They just threw on me. So.
Yeah, I think you got to change your shirt to start with.
G. Yeah, that ain't going to work. Therein lies my problem. I got to get dressed.
All right, man.
Thanks, Howard, Mark. For having us on and pushing the book.
Appreciate you. Take care, Mark.
All right. Later. ST.
That was our San Jose shout out there.
Okay.
ST was my high school, Santa Teresa.
Okay, Santa Teresa. Yeah.
we got to work in all the connections there. Our daily news connections, our San Jose connections with Spears. There's the aspect of Spencer Haywood that comes through the book many times where I feel like he struggles with himself a little bit, and even in terms of his own role. Like, I feel like he was an almost kind of a reluctant trailblazer. Like, he did this. He wasn't trying to be. I think he analogizes himself to Kaepernick at one point, that it wasn't about, like, I didn't set out to be a symbol or an activist or even a trailblazer or some kind of rabble rouser. He just did what he felt was right for himself, for others as well, of course. But like, it feels like he's almost reluctantly in that role. And then the blowback that he feels kind of shadows him his whole career because of it. It seems like he's still struggling to come to terms with kind of that trade-off.
Yeah, Howard, I think over the last few years, I mean, the Hall of Fame meant a lot to him. Having his number retired in Seattle, over the last like 10 to 12 years, he's gotten the recognition that he's deserved. But I do think he felt like he was kind of chewed up and spit out by the NBA. I feel like he felt like the league, there were owners who were still angry about him fighting the hardship role, because obviously, Howard, that changed the complexion of not only basketball, but professional sports. The league became younger. The league became more African-American. And now the NBA had to compete with the ABA for these players. The NBA had to work harder after Spencer Haywood entered the league, because there was no – they had to recruit better. They had to get, you know, better – they had to up their, you know, ante, because the ABA was just going to take these players and pay them. And so for Spencer, I think he felt like he made the ultimate sacrifice. You know, he goes to Seattle, then he gets traded to New York. Like, this is a lot of fascinating things. Like, he's basically playing with the Knicks in the late 70s, the aging Frazier, Phil Jackson on his last, like that. Like, people don't really talk about New York Knicks Spencer Haywood. Bob McAdoo was on that team. I mean, just you look at some of the things that obviously while I'm doing my research, it just took me like, wow, he was on some, like, he played with four or five different Hall of Famers, the retired, you know, A.J. DeBuscher and Bill Bradley. Like, he's on this team for the 76 Knicks, the Knicks that were obviously 3 or 4 years past their prime, but still trying to run it out there with Red Holtzman and That's where he met Iman. So that's an aspect. He played for the New Orleans Jazz, and I know no one remembers the New Orleans Jazz. They only think of they did not start in Utah. That name was created in New Orleans, and then the Lakers, and then obviously his time in Washington when he came back from Italy, because he was one of the first. I mean, just like Mark said, Forrest Gump, something one of the first major NBA players that was not finished to go to Europe, and to, you know, because Europe was a place in the 80s where a lot of guys who were on their last legs, who were, you know, wanted to make a little bit more money, wanted to finish their careers with a little something more in their pockets, went over there because there was no publicity in Europe. You know, there was nothing there. You know, it's not like now you can watch games on television. European players are coming to the States. There was not like that. So Spencer went to Italy when he was kind of the trailblazer there too, one of the first major NBA players to go and play overseas. So that's a lot of layers. And yeah, you're right, Howard. He's just kind of coming to grips with the fact of being appreciated. And I think he wants to be appreciated by these current guys who probably had no idea who he was or the sacrifices he made.
You mentioned that Knicks team. I was struck by that section of the book. Five future Hall of Famers on that team in 76, 77, but nobody in their prime, of course. So it's Spencer Haywood, Bob McAdoo, Clyde Frazier, Earl Monroe, Bill Bradley. They won 40 games, which just feels like a very Nick thing to have all these big names.
Yes.
And not win.
Totally. There's an HBO show that is currently on. I forgot the name.
The Deuce.
It talks about, it's New York in the late 70s, and how the guy walks in and goes, you know, damn, if Spencer would quit dating that supermodel and concentrate, the Knicks would be better. And it's like he's looking, and here he is, 71 years old, and he watches the show like, hold up, like, man, people are still taking it out on me. You know, so I thought that was kind of a hilarious part of like a current show about late New York 70s mentions Spencer not being completely locked in because he met the supermodel.
Knicks fans just never forget. One of the writers on that show had to have some New York ties. There's no question. The other that was funny too, Gary. Like there's a line there where he says, "quote They sold me as this savior coming to New York to save the Knicks, and now I got this outside life," meaning dating Iman and the fashion shows that he was going to, everything else. Which again just sounds like, oh my God, that's like 40 years ago.
Wow, that's Carmelo, that's Amari Stoudemire, that's 12 different guys who have been in New York since then.
Yes, like the story never changes. Like it's always savior complex coming to the Knicks, a fading star or a star who's maybe just can't quite get over the hump or doesn't have the right guys around him, and then, you know, criticized for outside stuff. The Iman thing is interesting. So again, for, you know, younger listeners, if you don't know, this is not Iman Shumpert. We're talking about Iman. Iman, the supermodel, who was, you know, one of the first of the supermodels, who he was married to for 10 years. She was married to David Bowie and for a long time, and was David Bowie's wife when David Bowie died with, what was it, 2 years ago. And so it also struck me, you and Spears both mentioned like the Forrest Gump thing. Like Spencer Haywood's married to Iman, who he met while he's playing for the Knicks, and then he gets into fashion and everything else. Iman ends up in the Michael Jackson Remember the Time video, which also, of course, prominently features Magic Johnson, who Spencer Haywood would play with, you know, had played with in L.A. for you. Like, it's just weird. All these intersections just kind of blew my mind. Because, to be honest, before your book, I don't think I ever knew that Spencer Haywood had been married to Iman for 10 years and had a daughter with her.
Yeah, totally. I mean, he's lived a life. I mean, he told me about playing for Bill Russell in Seattle. So, like, I'm like, how do you know Bill? I mean, because of the Seattle team. He said, yeah, well, I played for him. I'm like, well, we don't remember that Bill Russell, after he led the Celtics as a player coach to the championship, he later coached the Sonics in the mid-70s. And obviously he wasn't as successful, but he played for Bill Russell. So he got to know Bill Russell. So, I mean, just a lot of fascinating notes.
Yeah.
And I also thought, like, you know, kind of how he kind of was pushed out by the NBA. Like the interesting thing that he said, well, if you want the rest of your contract, you got to go to Italy. So it's like, the league doesn't want you here anymore. Then he comes back to Washington, and Iman gets in a car accident. He tries. I thought the saddest part was, you know, how it ended, trying out for the Pistons and basically being told by his hometown team, no, we don't need you. And this is the Pistons that were kind of on the verge of, with a young Isaiah, a younger Rick Mahorn, like they were on the verge of starting to make the play. We're not talking about the bad boys here. We're talking about the 83-84 Pistons. We're talking about a team that was kind of growing a franchise. So could they have used, you know, a five-time All-Star who was, I think, 32 or 33 at the time? They probably could have, but just he feels like politics and things kind of led to him just saying, you know, them just saying, no, we don't want you here. And not ending it kind of how he wanted to end it. He would have loved to have ended his career playing with his hometown Pistons.
Yeah. No, there's just a lot of sadness kind of sewn in or woven through his entire story, even though he has obviously an incredible career and an incredible life overall and has overcome a lot. And so in many ways, he's an inspiration. And he did, you know, he is in the Hall of Fame and he did win a championship with the Lakers, but he was banned from that parade and he didn't get a ring. He didn't get a ring until years later. It's just even the successes are kind of, you know, weighed down by these kind of these you know, various, you know, just negative aspects of his career or just moments that happened that in the moments were tough.
It's funny because we're talking about like who gets a ring and people are saying, well, Dion Waiters, regardless of what team wins, he'll get a ring because the Miami Heat and, you know, he played for the Heat. But if you look at Spencer's regular season numbers with the Lakers, like he was a contributing factor on that team. He was not just like, if you look at his numbers in that 79-80 year, he was definitely a contributing player. Like he deserved to get a ring. So it was kind of sad. Like now it would be no question, regardless of his troubles, he would have gotten a ring because he basically helped him get to the finals. But back then, because of the bad publicity, the league wanting to end or kind of put down any issues that it had of drug issues. And I know you remember, Howard, when Patrick Ewing and Michael Jordan kind of started doing the Just Say No commercials and that kind of thing. The league went out in his first campaign, kind of first, maybe David Stern's first act was to like, we need to eliminate that we're a drug league because we've got to boost the ratings. No more finals on tape delay. No more rumors that half of our guys are getting high. So they got some of the league's superstars and young superstars to kind of call, you know, speak out against drugs. And so Spencer kind of feels like he was made an example of unfairly.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, it's that famous David Stern quote when he tells his own story about how, you know, where the league was when he took over or when he first got to the league, even that it was considered too black and too drug riddled. Like that was that you know, that the fans, sports fans at large, especially white America, were not going to support this league with that impression. And so Spencer Haywood being made almost a poster boy for that, it does. It feels a little bit like he was used in a way that he was that you know, that they had to make somebody emblematic of it. But I wonder, Gary, and I'll leave it on this or as the last question just on his career. He doesn't get inducted into the Hall of Fame until 2015. And all the things that we're talking about, most of this is long, long ago. And the things that he achieved in the league, his greatness as a player, the teams he was part of, multiple All-Stars, multiple All-NBA, all this other stuff. Why do you think it takes until 2015 for him to be inducted into the Hall of Fame? Is it really that there were still ill feelings dating all the way back to him challenging the league from the early 70s? I mean, those team owners are all long gone. That those officials are long, like, it's a long time. And so there are times when I absolutely sympathize with him, but there are times in the book where I sometimes wonder, man, he's carrying a lot of resentment here that I feel like maybe is sprayed in a bunch of different directions where I'm not sure, like, is that really why he wasn't in the Hall of Fame until 2015? Is it really why he had a harder time kind of reconnecting with the league? And I could be wrong on that, but I just, some part of this feels like he's just carrying a lot of this still with him.
Yeah, I do think that there was an issues in terms of like after his career was over, you know, obviously he got clean. He became more of he got his own radio show in Detroit and he opened, he bought some real estate in the Detroit area. So he kind of invested in the area, concentrated on being a single dad. And then obviously he got married again. So I think he kind of like shut his door on the NBA for a while. Then I think, you know, in my time when I covered the Sonics in Seattle, Spencer was coming around again. He was starting to get the appreciation because he was an all-time great Sonic. I mean, and this is not the Sonic. This is the Sonics before they went and won their first championship in 79. He was kind of helped build that franchise because he was the only reason in many cases to go see the team in 1972, 1973, 74. You know, and so I think I just remember him, Howard, kind of coming back. The Sonics reached out to him and he got his number retired. Then I think he kind of underwent kind of a renaissance. And then the league, and I think the league has done a great job over recent years to reach out to these former players and make them feel more comfortable. I think that for years there were guys who just felt like they weren't included. I made some mistakes in my career, or I wasn't the greatest teammate. So do I deserve to be banned for life from any work in the NBA? I can't work for the league. I can't be a part of the NBA Cares events. I'm a legend. You know, I think Spencer finally became comfortable with his own skin in terms of like, okay, I made some mistakes, but I was a damn good player. And I think the league was like, you know what, you're right. And I think he built a good relationship with David Stern eventually, and then obviously with Adam Silver. And I do think that that's what led to the Hall of Fame. And then honestly, how people started looking at his numbers, 30 and 20 as a rookie for the Denver Rockets. So you can't rookie of the year and MVP, you know, five-time All-Star, NBA champion. You know, and then I think as you grow older, your legend grows. I think as we all know, some of these guys, you know, people start saying great things about Spencer, how great of a player he was. And so I think it was like, well, you know what? I think the only person he really hurt was kind of himself. I mean, Spencer had no harm for anyone else. Spencer was trying to do the right thing and just got caught up. So I do think that forgiveness kind of occurred, and he softened also. And I think that's the key part of the book, Fatherhood softened him. The fact that, you know, and I think it's interesting. It's a brilliant idea. He wants to open kind of a retirement home or old folks home, in a sense, for NBA players. And we know, Howard, you know, I know guys who are having major health issues, hip replacements, terrible. They can't exercise because their extremities won't allow and they're suffering. And now the Player Association has set up a program with medical insurance for these guys. And you don't have to play 12 years in the league to get it. You can be a 7 or 8 year guy and get medical insurance for, let's say, a much needed surgery. I think that is something that Spencer is proud of, because that's something that he spurred. He was like, I'm okay, but help some of these other guys who are getting, you know, these who, as you know, Howard, playing in low tops, playing in knee pads and hitting the hard floor and still getting up. They weren't Kawhi here. There was no load management. They weren't getting these state-of-the-art treatment. They weren't taking a game off or two. They're playing all 82 with torn tendons and torn ligaments and things like that. And now let's repay them for that, for their services.
And they weren't making a boatload back then either.
Yes.
You know, not even by 1970s or 1980s standards. These guys were not getting rich, most of them. And yeah, the retired players, you know, a lot of them certainly need that help. And I love the idea of a retired players kind of like retirement community where they're all, you know, all in one place and, you know, getting, you know, everything that they need, whether it's, you know, have medical care and attention and getting to hang out with each other. And I don't know.
Yeah, tell old stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, tell old stories. Yeah. I mean, Vegas would be a perfect place, great weather. I think that's his next big project. And I think for him to think not only about himself, because he's fine, you know, but for him to think about his brethren and guys, especially Howard and Lester, the guys who played in the NBA got nothing. Mm-hmm. Like the former ABA players were just left hanging because they merged with the NBA. So there's a lot of guys who played in the ABA most of their careers who were compensated with zero. And that's something that the NBA, I'm sure, has tried to address also, because it's a shame that happened. They got soaked in, the four teams, and then they just kept moving. So guys who played in Kentucky or, you know, the Memphis Tams and some of these teams, you know, who played in these small box arenas got nothing in terms of pensions and things like that.
Yeah, no, and a lot of them long since forgotten. Well, it's great stuff. The book, again, for listeners, it's The Spencer Haywood Rule, Battles, Basketball, and the Making of an American Iconoclast. from Mark Spears and Gary Washburn. Of course, you can follow both of them on Twitter, and you can see all Gary's work at the Boston Globe website. Spears on the Undefeated under the ESPN banner. This has been great, man. The book is phenomenal. Congrats to you guys getting this together, putting it out there, getting his story out there. I'm sure Spencer is incredibly gratified to kind of have this finally told. Overdue, I would say.
Yes, overdue, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. It was a pleasure doing the book and getting to know him. Obviously, he's 71 years old, but still very sharp. Looks great. I mean, just immaculate for all he's been through. Just still looks like he could go out there and hit a couple of jumpers.
Awesome. Well, hey, man, this has been great. Thanks again to Spears. I'm sorry he had to jump off early. Gary, this has been great. Thank you for making the time as well. I hope you guys both – I'm not rooting for anything, not rooting for any outcomes. But for your sake, as your friend, I hope you guys get to go home soon. And obviously, at worst, you're going home in like 7 days. So
exactly.
So good luck in your final days in the bubble. Get in some last games of pickleball or something.
Will do. Thanks a lot, Howard. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
All